Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. As of this week, Someone Else's Movie joins the Frequency Podcast Network, home to programs like The Quick and the Dirty, Moms in the Middle, Black Tea, Three Trips Ahead, The Legal Podcast, Roz and Mocha, and The Big Story, a weekday news podcast on which I've appeared a few times, most recently this past Friday. I'm delighted to bring Semcast into the fold, and if this is your first encounter with the show, please enjoy it and the 234 previous episodes. If you're a longtime subscriber, I assure you the show will remain as eccentric and eclectic as it's ever been. It's not like I know how to change. My guest this week is filmmaker Larry Weinstein, whose long list of credits includes the Canadian Screen Award-winning documentary Our Man in Tehran and the Emmy-nominated documentary September Songs, The Music of Kurt Weill. His recent Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas was nominated for an international Emmy, and his latest documentary, Propaganda, The Art of Selling Lies, opens in Toronto this Friday, July 19th, at the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Cinema. It's a comprehensive history of state-sponsored messaging and the artistic response to it over the centuries, and you should probably check it out. Larry picked Amarcord, Federico Fellini's 1973 memoir of growing up in the little town of Rimini in the 1930s. Over the course of a year, we're introduced to the townsfolk and shown their eccentricities and rituals, all while the specter of fascism rises in the nation around them. Amarcord, which literally means I remember, is somehow both a celebration of and elegy for Fellini's home place, its elaborate whimsy almost but not quite covering up the darkness at its heart. Winner of the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film in 1975, it was nominated for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay the following year, thanks to a quirk of scheduling, losing to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Dog Day Afternoon, respectively, which is a weird, slightly surreal, and kind of ridiculous touch that's perfectly in line with the tone of the film. You'll see. This is someone else's movie.
Amarcord is just a film that has, from the moment I saw it, it's never really let go of me. I think of it constantly in life. I guess I went when it first opened in Toronto, and I'm not even sure exactly when that was. I think it was, though it was made in late 73, I think it was only released in Italy at the end of 73. So I think it was only in Toronto in the fall of 74.
At the earliest, yeah. I mean, it won the Oscars, so that would have
the
been
75 the spring. Foreign Oscar. And then I think it's the only film that then will qualify for Oscars a year later because it had its American release, which is quite amazing. It was at a time when I used to go with my friends, like when we were 16, 17, 18, we would go downtown. We lived in North York. We were bored. And we'd go and see films. And the films that we saw were things like Death Wish with Charles Bronson or Magnum Force I had a macho friend who liked those kinds of things. But we also, you know, there's Mean Streets and I was really fond of Serpico and there were silly films at the time too, which I actually didn't see. Thank goodness, Crazy Larry, Dirty Mary, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, which I just happened to see last week, but it was made in 73 as well. But most of the films we saw were kind of serious and kind of based on realism and then Taxi Driver eventually. And you know, some of them were really good films. They had strong social messages. And then we went to see Amarcord, and it was a whole different thing. It was a celebration.
And it's not like any of the films you've just described. I mean, it's not a conventional movie in any respect, right?
Yeah.
Were you familiar with Fellini's stuff at the time?
No, I had never seen a Fellini film. So this was Fellini to me, or this was a whole world to me. Mm-hmm. But I also had not been to Europe before, and I had not been... So I didn't know what this was, how much of this was fantasy, of it was real. Obviously, there's dream imagery, but... You know, or in fact, is that what Europe is? Is that what Italy is?
Well, it does. I hadn't seen it for a while, and then I watched it again just the other day in preparation for this, and it struck me, two things hit me really hard. One is that it is much more garish than I remember. I mean, I remember it being exaggerated,
but it's fleshy and it's yes. vulgar in a way that's not...
It's kind of logical.
Yeah, but it's not offensive. It's just an aesthetic, right? Like, he sort of embraced it the way that Pasolini did with the Canterbury Tales and yes. that trilogy, just the sense that he was going to kind of rejoice in every aspect of people, and that brings in perversity and sexuality and all those things. Yes. Like, it feels like a child's memory in a way, because he yes. doesn't fully understand what we aren't led to fully understand what we're seeing.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Yes, yes. And it's episodic and it's dreamlike and it deals with very serious subjects. It yeah. deals with you know, fascism and the growing fascism, because it's his childhood, or at least based on memories perhaps of his childhood in the 30s, even though he might have denied that it was exactly autobiographical.
Oh yeah, it's very it's exaggerated in a way that makes you feel safe somehow from offense. You
know, yes.
Like, these are the people I remember. I'm sure that's not correct.
But it's interesting, I remember, the translation of Amarcord, exactly. being I remember, even though it's from that dialect, Italian dialect, accordi. You know, we used to hear that word and we think of amar or amore, it feels like love. And it's in fact, that it is a love letter. It's a love letter through some kind of prism that has to do with childhood. And you're right. It's very smiling, very warm, very affectionate. So yes, it's not direct contact with, there's a serious issue of growing fascism and Mussolini, which led towards Hitler and eventually to Trump.
Well, that's the other thing that struck me this time through. It's just like, oh shit, we're there again. Like, this is not in any way yeah. removed
yes.
the way it used to be.
Yes.
I mean, you could watch it in, I assume in the 70s, I think I first saw it in the late 80s. My first experience of it was always in that charming, like they're all a bunch of idiots careening towards this disaster. But the fact that Fellini made the movie means yeah. they'll recover. There's a sense that the world will be better. And now it's like, nope, cyclical, didn't catch it.
Yeah.
Here we are again.
Yeah. But you know, there's also, like, in terms of these serious issues, he also, his approach to religion
yeah.
is also very interesting. So, you know, you start, if you do a little research about him, about Fellini himself, was he anti-church? Was he an atheist? Was he, how political was he? Well, he thought of himself as being rather apolitical, mm-hmm.
But look at his movies.
But look at his movies. And he comes out of that whole neoclassical
both, really.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. His films are very much a neorealist. Response to neorealism.
Neorealism, yeah.
Although and it started that way, but then he just pivoted into his own direction
yeah.
so quickly.
Yeah. Didn't he? I think he actually collaborated with Rossellini at one point as
yeah,
well. And he came from this realism. It's a little bit, I guess it's paralleled a little bit to Bertolucci, who was indeed very communistic, mm-hmm. and Fellini never would have been that or thought he was that. But they are human beings, and they respond to things in human ways. And in the case of Amarcord, well, there's always that layer of smiling and humor and affection. I mean, obviously not affection for fascism, but even that is done in the kind of a weird, perverse way with
yeah.
that huge thing of Mussolini's face made from flowers that becomes part of one of the kids' sexual fantasy in yeah. a weird way.
Or the sequence in the hotel room in the suite with
Gradisca.
Yeah, but her encounter with the, like, all the levels of power are represented
yes.
somehow, and we don't fully understand why she wants
yeah.
to be there, but she knows, and it's disturbing, and
it's very strange.
Eyes wide shutty.
It's very strange because there's so many ways of looking at the film, and I think when I did watch it a few days ago, and I there was this one scene that I looked at for a very specific reason. I mean, I looked at it first purely, but I think I was distracted for a moment. And it's when you see almost all the characters in the town, and you hear Nina Rota's wonderful score, and which we can talk about a bit
yeah.
more. But everyone comes out, and there's this carriage that goes through the town
yeah.
with women in the carriage. And I somehow misunderstood it when I was first, I think I was distracted, and I thought it was like royalty or some kind of, I don't know, women who were wives of fascist leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But there's Gradisca, the town beauty, who kind of looks like Sophia Loren, yeah. but is obviously influenced by the romance of American films and Ronald Coleman and Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire and all these other. And she is looking up, and she's so sentimental as she looks at these women and looking at them longingly.
Yeah.
And then I thought, who are those women? And just before I came to speak to you, I thought, I think I better look at that one scene again, and realize it was the local madam who ran a brothel, yeah. And this was... These were the new crop of prostitutes she had just brought in. And everybody in town, the children and the old men and everybody is coming to gather to see these new visitors who are there for sex.
Yeah, they're there to check them out. And it's...
Yeah.
It's creepy. I'm not sure if I caught it the first time either, now that you mention it. Because they're all just sort of rushing and it's...
Well, it's so about, nostalgic.
Yeah.
And it ends. It does this... So it seems choreographed. The whole thing's choreographed with all of these characters. And you see faces after faces in front of the camera. And some of them are running to the camera. Like, it's very directed, but it's so natural. And there's one main narrator in the film. And it's strange, because what is the point of view of this film? And we can talk about that. Sure. But there's this one main narrator who identifies himself as the lawyer. And he's obviously a historian. He tells us a lot about the town, which is Rimini.
Yes, but he also keeps going back and saying, well, that's one version.
Yeah. But he's telling us a lot of hard facts, like documentary facts.
Oh, that's right. He's the one.
And so it's a whole hybrid kind of thing, because this is also a documentary. Anyway, he's at the end of the scene. He's at the beginning of the scene telling us some facts about the town and its architecture. And then he kind of whispers to us and says, oh, we'll come back to that later. And then at the very end of the scene, that seems like one shot. It's not, but it feels like it. Yeah. He just looks at the camera. We've just seen all these prostitutes. He looks into the camera and smiles and gives us a shrug, like, that's life here. But what's interesting, it fades out on him, and behind him is a window that has lots of Madonnas holding candles. It's totally the religious thing, but it's a scene about, you know, sex.
It's just a fact of life.
It's just a fact of life. And I realized that shrug, that little smile and shrug, I realized it's something that really stayed with me through my life. And then I became a filmmaker right after this, watching this film. And or at least in my mind, I was a filmmaker. I didn't actually direct a film professionally for another 10 years. But
the consciousness was forged.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear about that all the time, where people just came out of a film for the first time and realized, oh, someone made that. That was directed.
Yeah.
That was constructed. Yeah. And like, to have that experience with a Fellini film is... kind of incredible, because I'm still kind of reeling over the idea of, what if this was someone's first exposure? Like, it was your first exposure
to Fellini.
How do you even begin to process the symbolism and
right away you understand that idea of Fellini-esque, mm-hmm. or you sort of get it, like, because no one else is like this. Well, it's like Bergman-esque as well, right?
And I'm a little younger. I came up after he was already... Like, I somehow knew what that was before I ever saw any of his films.
Yeah.
My first one would probably have been... Probably La Dolce Vita.
Which is back from... 62?
62, 63, yeah. Back when it was still... I mean, that's more or less still realist.
It has some of that celebrative, like the crowds of people and I hadn't seen, you know, it's funny, I was very aware of Fellini after Amarcord, and I went back and saw Satyricon immediately. I thought, oh well, Amarcord's quite tame compared to Satyricon, and I saw Roma, and I saw actually, I went to see 8½ several times, but every time I went to a cinema to see it, the film print, because they would show for film prints, would break. I didn't even get half, let alone 8½.
Oh, my God.
So it took many years to see 8½. And then I finally saw La Dolce Vita, which is part of the reason I wanted to see it, other than being such a great Fellini film, is I knew Nico was in it.
Right.
And I am a Velvet Underground freak and a Lou Reed freak, so I wanted to see this woman, but... But that's a digression.
No, it's all part of the process. I saw La Dolce Vita in film school. I saw it at York.
Oh, really? Oh, I went to York, too.
Yeah, in 87, 88.
Yeah.
And so that was at least I saw it theatrically, which was nice, but that was my first exposure to Fellini. And then I think the next one shortly after that, Satyricon came out on Laserdisc, of all things, from Criterion, and that's how I saw that.
And right. And there's Clowns, of course, which is City of Women, which is not as good. I mean, if I can say that, but am I allowed to say that?
I don't think so.
For me,
they can't all be gems. Right? There's got to be. There's a range in any artist.
You know, it's funny. I when I went to York, it was from like 76 to 79, 80. Mm-hmm. And I took a couple of film courses, maybe three film courses, with the wonderful critic Peter Harcourt.
Oh, yeah.
And he had written a book called Six European Directors that came out sort of the same year Amarcord was released. But so he didn't include Amarcord in it. But Fellini was one of his directors. Right. And he was going on and on about how great Fellini was and how rigorous he was and vigorous. But I heard that he really disliked Amarcord.
Really?
Because he thought it was a film that just kind of let go and was just too indulgent and too decadent or something. I'm not sure what it was, but I purposely have not read his reviews of Amarcord because I don't want to be poisoned by someone that I actually really did respect. And sure. and Peter was the guy who was such a good teacher because he had such an appetite for films, and he loved the magic and the sensuality of films. In other words, all the things I love about Amarcord were kind of embodied in what he taught us, and yet he disliked it.
This one.
Yeah. I think sometimes it is. What is your first exposure to something? Mm. And I really feel, even though I had seen other Scorsese films, Raging Bull was the first one I really looked at.
Okay.
And I think of it as one of the top five films of all time. And I don't want to go back and see it again in a way, because what if I'm wrong?
I see. No, I don't understand that experience.
I remember when I used to...
Kale used to say that, didn't she? Pauline Kael would refuse to see films again because she might not like them.
Oh.
Or she argued that she'd already... What was it? She'd already digested them or something like that. Some strange evasion that clearly was, I might not feel the same way. But to me, that's the beauty of film, right? The film doesn't change. We do.
Yes.
And our interpretation gets to evolve.
Yes.
Raging Bull totally holds up, by the way.
Yes, I believe it. I'm not actually scared of Raging Bull to see it again. One film that I wish I hadn't seen again was Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Really?
Yeah, I loved it when it was out. And I loved it almost in reaction against Star Wars.
Okay.
Sure. Which I wanted to hate. I also wanted to hate it because I love 2001 so much. Mm-hmm. And then this other thing came out with a lot of special effects. Right,
the non-cerebral science fiction.
Yeah, and then here's a film that has Francois Truffaut in it. And anyway, that's a whole other thing.
But you revisited Close Encounters?
I saw it on an airplane. Maybe that was the mistake.
Yeah, that's no way to watch it. I did once test myself. I took Jaws and Lawrence of Arabia on a 5-inch Sony Watchman.
Yes.
A flight in the 90s to California, just one there, one back, as an experiment, just to see if they'd work.
I'm sure they did.
They did, but it was because I'd already seen them, and my brain was filling in the scale.
Well, Jaws.
But Close Encounters would be so...
It's funny when you asked me what films that I didn't choose Jaws.
Oh.
Because when I was 18, I saw it 50 times.
Wow.
Only because I was an usher.
Okay.
And after people sat down, I'd sit down and watch it again. And I got to meet Spielberg, and I got to tell him that.
Really?
Yeah.
So did you get used to... I mean, because my experience of... We're going to talk about Jaws for a few minutes.
Okay.
My experience of Jaws is similar in that I gorged myself on it when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Like a shark.
Pretty much. I just feeding frenzied my way through it over and over again. And now when I see it, and I... love it. It's one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
But when I watch it, I kind of start watching the audience at key points. So you would have had that same experience to know when the shocks are coming and start to watch the crowd and how they process it.
Oh, yes.
But in 1975, that would be a radically different experience.
Yes. I was upset with myself because I didn't know I was going to... I knew I wanted to be an usher, but I didn't know that the film theater that I was going to be at was going to be showing Jaws. And that, of course, it was going to be such a success. I would get to see no other films in those months.
Right, because movies ran for years.
Yeah.
Which theater was it?
It was called the Fairlawn Theater. So I had already gone to see Jaws. I had paid for it. So that's why I'm angry at myself that night, because I didn't want to. It was a full $250. And but I remember loving it, and you know, I respond very strongly to music, and I think the score of Jaws, I think it's one of the great John Williams scores.
Oh yeah,
that's one of the problems I have with Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I think that stupid theme, ba 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 ba, it's like, oh, what is that otherworldly sound that they're making? I think it's called a tuba. But anyway, Jaws had a great track, except there's one moment in Jaws that rings false. I felt it the moment I saw it before I was an usher, where there's like just too much optimism in the music. Like they're going off, right. You know,
it's
there's
the barrel sequence, right?
Yes, that's right.
Music that comes.
That's right.
I love it because it lets you have fun for a second before they start slipping on the
guardrail. I guess so. Hey, you know, it's funny that you were talking about Jaws. There's in Amarcord, there's a scene which directly relates to a scene in Jaws, believe it or not. And it has to do with the lighting.
Okay.
And when the main character, or at least the one that we're thought to be, is thought to be the equivalent of a Fellini at the time,
yeah.
Tita.
The Avatar, yeah.
Yeah. He, you know, has these sexual obsessions, and he obviously likes large women with large everything.
Yeah.
And he's in that shop after hours, the tobacconist, is that a real word? Tobacconist,
yes,
shop, shop. He obviously desires her, and she basically takes him on. He says that he's a strong guy and he can lift her. And this whole sex scene has to do with him being able to lift this large woman. And then she gets excited and reveals her breasts and gets him to sort of have fun with them, I guess, but which actually makes him ill. So there's some kind of moral thing happening. But while he's lifting her, she's got an exposed light bulb, and she hits it. He lifts her, now obviously her head hits the exposed light bulb, and the bulb is swinging, and there's the shifting shadows. The same thing happens in Jaws, not with the woman, but when they're down below.
Yeah, the attack of the Orca. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Singing, "Show me the way to go home," and then the shark. And then bang, and you see the light bulb swinging.
I thought the bulb in Amarcord was a reference to Psycho somehow, that he was sort of hat-tipping there, but you're right, it continues through.
I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure we've seen this in a lot of films.
And it's
but
a year later, so clearly.
It's only a year later, yeah. Another thing that's very personal for me, I, like I said, I had never been to Europe before.
Yeah.
And I was in, at the time, grade 13, which we had back then in Ontario, and they had chosen, they still have school trips to different countries and stuff, and there was this 10-day trip that they had offered to somewhere in the world, and I chose Italy. It was the first time I was going to go to Europe, and I think it's not a coincidence that I chose Italy after seeing Fellini's Amarcord, and in fact, a couple of friends that I went to see Amarcord with, we all went.
Okay.
And it was fantastic, and it was wonderful, and it was sensuous, and it wasn't quite Fellini-esque, because we were in Florence, and we were in Rome, and Pompeii, it was like life. There was something so wonderful and so different from North York.
Yeah.
Although we had a lot of Italian food, I guess.
Italian food in Toronto in the '70s and eighties was not Italian food now as we know it.
But
no,
it changed.
I grew up at. I was at Young and Steeles. I was like.
Oh really?
The ass end of the city.
Oh, that's interesting. Young and Steeles. That's where I'm going tonight for my dance lesson with my wife.
We were across the road from Farmland, which presumably is now a bunch of strip malls where the dance lesson will be.
Yeah.
And
so you're close to the Willow.
Yes, I went to the Willow. I was there the last night. I was there at the last show of the Willow. It was a double bill of, I want to say it was Best Seller and No Way Out, maybe?
Wow.
In 1987 when they closed it down.
Oh.
Or maybe it was an early eight, but yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Beloved neighborhood double bill theater I saw.
Do you remember what month that was? Do you remember summer? Was it fall?
I think it would have been the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
I was editing a film on Maurice Ravel at the time.
Well,
so I missed
it. Good reason to miss it.
So did that lead? Is that why I chose you? It was interesting because I just looked at the dates today, and it was Holy Year, 1975.
Okay.
and a holy year, I'm saying, as a Catholic, which I'm not. But I went to the Vatican and I saw Pope Paul, and I had a Super 8 camera and I filmed him. Oh, there were so many, it was too dark, but there were so many flashes going off. He was on one of those big things that they're carrying down the aisle. And yes.
Yeah.
So I have this incredible Super 8 footage of all these lights flashing at this head of us, you know, the church of a God that probably doesn't exist, but that's a whole other thing. And I got back, I realized it was the first week of April, and the Oscars that Abercorn won was within a week of that time.
Okay.
I think that was April 8th, 1975. And I got back, I think, the 4th. So somehow it bookended. Seeing it and then it being recognized bookended my own trip. And I don't know, but it's kind of neat.
It's a sign. I mean, it's a cinematic sign. It's the sort of thing that would... Yeah, it would
start... A sign from the cinematic gods like Fellini.
Yeah, it would open and close a film about your trip, right? That would be...
Yeah.
That would be the scope of the narrative.
Yeah.
So was the... What was the experience of Italy like? I mean, it wouldn't have been tiny rural Italy, right? You were in big cities.
We were big cities, although Florence compared to Toronto was smaller. But we did go out to towns and had some of the food and big long tables that I kind of identified from you know, the wedding scenes. And you saw the people who were all using their hands. I didn't ever use my hands when I spoke before I went there. Now I notice I'm doing it all the time. It's like an affectation I picked up from Italy and from Fellini. I just noticed this passion. There seemed to be a passion. And I remember the very first morning I was there, I had curly, big afro like dark hair and was actually thin, and some American tourists immediately came up to me to ask me, like, they thought I was Italian. And the idea that I could be Italian, that I could be part of the Fellini film myself, I don't know, it's all blended and magical and great. And can I just say in that regard, please, also, because I don't want to forget this because it was so strange. In around the early 2000s, I was invited to a film festival to show some of my films in Riccione. Riccione is a small town on the Adriatic coast.
Okay.
And it was it was a good festival, but it was a total disappointment as a town. I wanted Italy as I knew it. Right. I wanted something magical and beautiful. And there was a beach, of course, because it's seaside, but it was all non-Italians, Germans and Scandinavian people who were very white-skinned and not the dark Italians.
Right.
And it was kind of cold, but they were jumping in. And it's funny because...
It's the opening of the film.
It's the opening of Abercorn, where they're talking about the Germans.
As soon as winter ends, the Germans are...
And they don't know that it's cold, I think is what the narrator says. So anyway, I was kind of depressed that I was in such a, I thought, unattractive part of Italy. Like, why am I here? That's why I wanted to go. And somebody said, oh, you can take a taxi. It's 5 kilometers away is Rimini.
Oh.
Which I had forgotten that was the setting of Abercorn.
Okay.
So I went by myself and I went through the gates and I was suddenly in the town square. And I started thinking for the first time in my life, maybe there is afterlife. Maybe I feel like I was here in an earlier life. And it was 25 years since I'd seen Abercorn.
You just hadn't made the connection.
I had not made the connection. But as I walked through the streets and looking at the different buildings, I was having like weird filmic flashbacks. So I would look up at the bell tower and I would see the phonograph that was playing the Internationale that the fascists shot down. Or all these other scenes that happened in Abercorn. I recognized the buildings and the square and the cobblestones. And then I thought, Abercorn. This is Abercorn. This is where we shot. Oh, well, that means this is where Fellini grew up. And it was just so wonderful. It was just by...
To just luck into it.
Yeah.
Whenever I've tried a pilgrimage, it hasn't worked out. It's been too small or too strange or too gentrified. And, you know, New York isn't the New York from the movies that I saw
right.
in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
It's nice that the Ghostbusters firehouse is still there. That's basically it. To recapture something like that, yeah... That would be lovely.
It was.
And to do it unwittingly would be the sort of thing that would make it into, again, a movie about Abercorn, because so much of that, I just keep coming back to the intuitive nature of it, the way he didn't apparently start with a script. He used photographs to cast it and then just built stories for those characters that he then had to literally construct so he could shoot them. And it's just...
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, that it has no narrative, really, yeah. That it's all about the subtext of creeping fascism and people just blundering into the yeah. darkest period of their nation's history.
Yeah.
It feels like... Yeah, it feels like a miracle that it happened. It feels like a miracle that it works, that it plays as well as it does. The just that weird wobbly construction of when people do and don't talk to the camera shouldn't work. It should, like, I should be offended by the slapdash nature of that because...
Well, in this case, sometimes they do look right at the camera and yeah, talk to the yeah, camera. Yeah. And it works, and it's so strong.
And it plays beautifully. Yeah. It's, once you realize the narrators are unreliable... It all snaps together. It's just like, oh, well, this is a version. This is a history. This
but also, is... you don't know who the, at first who the narrator is because there's that sort of homeless-looking yeah, guy.
Yeah, people just start talking to the camera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and people... And then you find somebody out that Fellini actually would go and cast homeless people yeah. and give them lines. And sometimes they'd forget their lines.
Yeah.
And but it was that feeling of it didn't matter.
It was that great... It's that joke in... It's in Day for Night, right? Valentina Cortese, I think, says it. That Fellini would just... Federico would just give us numbers to shout. and you dub it in later because he never posted... He never did sing yeah. sound. And you sort of feel the randomness of it all serving the greater purpose of this movie that is coming together while you watch it. Like a memory or a reverie. Yes. And I don't know... how he did it, because he never did anything else like it. He did films that were fantastical, he did films that were surreal, but he never did this again. Or, yeah. or before. And it's so fascinating. You know, like, Truffaut starts with The 400 Blows and continues in that vein, more or less for his entire career,
yes.
of the observational camera.
Yes.
And he would work within different genres and change things up, but he always had the same sort of eye
yes.
in a film. And this feels like, this is the movie that people think about when they think about Fellini, but it's not like any of his other movies.
Maybe that's why people also reject it. That's why critics start to dislike, or he's devalued sometimes, mm-hmm. or disliked. Like, because it's so easy to love those earlier films, like La Dolce Vita, or Eight and a Half, and they're very strong, and they are a bit more conventional,
yeah.
though they have elements of this. But suddenly, this is like a free form. It's like falling in love with classical music. It's hard to start to love jazz. There's something very improvisational about this. That's, and then once you get it, once you feel for it, it's hard to go back.
Yeah, and it is yeah. so specifically. I mean, I was going to say so specifically Italian, but that's not right. What it is that it defined what we think of as specifically Italian going forward.
Yeah,
right. Because all the other maybe Mamma Roma, maybe
yeah.
had done it before, but
yeah.
In that same sort of, you know, embrace of the earthiness and embrace of the bigger-than-life
yeah.
characterizations. But this film does it for the town, like the way the town is an organism. And you mentioned the scene that has the entire town in it, but there are three or four moments
oh, yes.
where everyone flows together. The yes. opening sequence at the festival, and then there's going out to see the wrecks, obviously, is another
yes.
huge, huge moment where the town is a single thing.
Yes.
Of this collection of arguing, weird, counterintuitive personalities who are all just fighting with each other, but then they all stop to do this one thing together.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. There are people who are separate or do things that are separate from other people, but those are the harrowing moments, like Volpina.
Yes.
She's alone. Yeah.
She's always alone. And most of the women in close-up have their faces painted chalk white, which I found really unsettling the first time, and now I'm still not sure I understand it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just an exaggeration of makeup, but Volpina looks like a corpse. And yes. she's supposed to be the most desirable person.
Yeah, the sensuous.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on, and it's probably not politically correct, but talking about her as the town nymphomaniac.
The town nymphomaniac, yeah.
/ prostitute / whatever. But also the uncle who goes up the tree who's all alone. It stays with you. You know, the fact that Aurelio,
Aurelio, yeah.
the father of Tita, the mad, angry, it's so funny. I mean, the family dynamic, it's so passionate and angry, and the mother says, "I'm gonna kill myself," and the father says, "No, I'm gonna kill myself," and he tries to rip his jaw open because it's just so larger than life. And
both of us were, you know, as Jewish kids were presumably not unfamiliar with exaggerated emotional states.
Yeah.
But this was, you're right. This is like nothing I'd ever
seen. And maybe that has something to do with the attraction to that too. It's like, well, we're North York kids, so it's not exactly the same as these crazed Italian people at this time, but it sort of is.
Sure. Yeah.
Heavy carb based cultures.
and diasporas in their own way.
Yeah, that's
people true. Of Romania are isolated in their own space.
Yeah. So, you know, he takes his brother out of the sanatorium or the asylum, as they say, and he seems kind of okay, and he's smiling, and they're all happy, and he climbs up that tree and just screams in that primal way, "I want a woman! I want a woman!" When anyone goes near her, I don't know if he's throwing fruit from the tree. I think it's rocks that he's throwing on people.
Yeah, he's probably brought them with him. Because
he's got rocks in his pocket. And it's so harrowing. And it's so... You feel so much for him. And then that, as they say, that they bring that dwarf nun, mm-hmm. who is the only one who can climb the ladder and just say, "I'm not putting up with this anymore." And he comes down and he's smiling. But... that screaming, that primal, "I want a woman," it's not that different from the adolescence in the group masturbation scene in the car, which is so funny because the car is, you know, with its flashlights, headlights that are blinking as they're doing what they're doing and calling out women's names. It's, or those scenes that scan across the bicycle seats.
Yes. It's all just so, it's lustful in a way that it feels, it's deeply politically incorrect.
Yes.
I cannot imagine anyone making a film like this now. It's simply because it is so objectifying of every woman in the film.
Yes.
But it's also tapping into something really fascinating and distressing about the idea of intimacy and the way people who most need some sort of connection are the least likely to get it because they can't articulate it or they're just disasters at social mores and social graces. It sort of explains to me while I'm watching it. It explains to me why the brothels are there.
Yeah.
What that satisfies in the towns.
And that they all accept it.
And that, everybody just has to go along to get along with this because it is so unpleasant to talk about. Because also you've got Catholicism. You've got that additional layer of religious shame around sexuality.
Well, you know, ultimately it's a film maybe about ritual because it's all about the seasons. It starts in the spring, it ends in the spring. The burning of the effigy of the witch to go from winter to spring, and the whole town gathers, and it's and the madam bringing in the new prostitutes. This is like something for the town to celebrate, whether they understand it or not. It's just, there's just too many things to talk about with this film. It crackles with so much life force. It's very moving and very nostalgic. And I when I watched it last week, I couldn't stop smiling the whole time. My face was in pain. And because it's so nostalgic, it's instantly nostalgic, even though it's not your own. I mean, you might draw parallels with your own culture or not, but it's a very specific culture. You're learning about a culture as well, but you're instantly drawn in. And I think a large part of that is the Nina Rota score.
Well, I was going to say, a great deal of, because it could have been, you know, take the music out and you could almost have Roma. You could almost have
know,
Alfonso Cuarón's sort of emotional anthropology thing where you just stare at a culture and watch it.
Yeah.
But the music, it makes it a carnival. It invites you in.
Yeah, go ahead. You said you were going to sing the theme.
No. I said I'm legally prohibited from singing.
Oh, that's what you said.
In front of my
I can't sing, but it's that... Da dum dum da 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 dum.
Yeah.
It's immediately like it makes you moan with nostalgia. And then at one point, in that scene that I was talking about, while you're looking at these prostitutes coming in, it starts going da 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 da, which is the 1933, I think, Stormy Weather by Harold Arlen. I made a film called Stormy Weather. That melody was in my head forever, and I didn't even know what it was. I thought, oh, is that Nina Rota?
So was that the first time you encountered the song, you think?
I think I had heard it already, but that's when it was locked into my brain.
Right.
And there are certain things that were locked into my brain. That shrug that wonderful narrator does at the end. I've done that a couple times in my own films, where there is something very big, and then I told the actor, even though I make documentaries, in theory, I would tell the actor to look into the camera at the end of this big thing, and there's no words left to say, so do a little smile and shrug looking into the camera. And it's always like this hair-raising in your neck moment. Yeah. It feels like Maurice Chevalier, in a way, the way he would shrug and Gigi or something like that.
But when you do it, you're communing with Armacord. You're connecting yourself to that, too.
Yes.
So it's
even
more weighted.
Yes. Although now I've made a film about Leslie Caron, so maybe it's also Maurice Chevalier as well.
Echoes within echoes.
No, it's definitely Armacord. And I didn't realize it was Armacord when I did it. I it was in my own subconscious film vocabulary. But in that regard, I have to say that I think it's partly having seen Armacord at a time when I was just determining that I want to be a filmmaker. I had made a little dramatic film with some friends, a comedy in school. I had just become a vegetarian, and I made a film about a slaughterhouse to reinforce my decision.
Okay.
And at that point, I thought, I'm going to study film in school. And then I went to Italy after seeing Armacord, and it all kind of blended into one experience. But I was going to say that I think the thing about Armacord, because it's nostalgic and makes you smile, but it's also very serious, and it's kind of anti-church, and it's about the dangers of fascism, and it alternates between scenes that are very serious or sad or poignant with things that are overtly funny. And I love that. It's like a classical symphony with a fast movement and then a slow moving movement and then bang, alas. And that was very instructional to me as a filmmaker, because I love, even in my documentaries, I don't make earnest issue-based documentaries generally. They have humor and seriousness, and I think the contrasts make it much stronger in the end. And I think I kind of got that from this kind of film. And when I say this kind of film, probably this film.
Right. Because there aren't any other kinds of... I mean, there are people who have tried to make their own version of Armacord, but they have gone wide or just missed it completely.
Yeah, I mean, I really loved... what is the word beauty is in it? It just was from 3 years ago. Not Life is Beautiful, but...
Object of Beauty? No.
No, it's the Italian film. The Great Italian...
Oh, The Great Beauty.
The Great Beauty. The Great Beauty has that crazy lust for life and characters. Even that small, the little person woman, which reminds me of the nun in Armacord. There's something very... In those... not for all the scenes, but there's a lot of Fellini. And I think it was compared to Fellini.
I think, rightly so. Probably.
Yeah.
He's definitely influenced. I was thinking of Leolo, Jean-Claude Lauzon's film.
Yes.
From maybe 91, 92.
Yeah.
Which just does that thing.
Yeah.
Exquisitely well, of showing you not just how he remembers something, but how it also probably was, hinting at it in the second layer, just the scene with the bully that remains a bully, and the kid, this child, the narrator's brother, Leolo's brother, who is bullied by an older boy and commits himself to bodybuilding and works out so he'll never be bullied again. And then finally, after I think it's years, 2 or 3 years of toning and conditioning, he's played by a different actor, and he's this massive bodybuilding character, shows up and is ready to face his bully down, and he's still inside, he's still a small boy, he can't handle it, and it's just this heartbreaking moment.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you what happened, and I'm going to illustrate it in such a way that it is going to be more powerful than just watching the real thing.
Yeah.
And Armacord finds a way to do that with fascism. Somehow he found an analog, not even an allegory, but a straight visual analog for the banality of power and the corruption of Italy and Europe before the war. And it's just so simple that I'm not even sure I caught it the first time.
Yeah.
Everybody just grins a little too much, and everybody just shines a little too brightly, and the clothes are a little too sharp, and these are the people with power, and they're about to abuse it.
Yeah. It's interesting when the fascists first march in, there's all this smoke, like very brown, awful smoke. It's like this pollution. It's like if you could smell it, there's this awful smell that comes in.
Yeah, they're bringing it with them.
But and it is confusing. There's Gradiska, the desirable woman of the town, who is so sentimental as she is with the ship, the Rex that comes. Yeah. She says, "I want to touch the Il Duce. I want to just touch him." Mm-hmm. She's inspired by it. And then most of the men and all the boys are lusting after Gradiska, and you understand that's how these things happen. Often,
they just follow it's that to basic. Hell. Yeah.
I mean, that's what the Nazi youth were all about, and the way their relationships with the boys and girls, and you know, wow, yeah, it's heavy stuff.
Yeah, give people something to aspire to, and you can. I mean, again, Trump, right? A reality television figure for a decade, and now everyone thinks they'll be the one who wins.
Yeah,
like, he'll be my friend. He won't hurt me.
Yes,
and very quickly we realized, no, that's. He's coming for everybody. Yeah. That steamroller is on its way.
Yeah.
But Amarcord does it so gently and so sweetly, strangely enough, that you come away feeling, you know, oh, I've just watched a nation slide into its own destruction, but it still feels heartening and pleasurable because you can see the humanity of everybody involved.
Yes.
And again, that's...
Yes, there's no villains in
not
this.
Not really, no. There are people who grasp. That's about it. They reach for too much and they want too much.
And you see people annoying other people.
Yeah.
But it makes
petty irritation, right?
Yeah.
And then as soon as you have power, you put the petty person in prison. And that's the beginning of it. That's how it all starts.
But there's also so much magic, and it's related to the dreams. Some of the things that are portrayed as real have a dreamlike quality, whether they're the puffballs at the beginning.
Right.
And
the sequence of the Emir visiting, which is just...
Oh, well, that's pure...
Hella racist, but also...
With the harem.
Yeah.
And Bessine, or I forget the name of the man who was the vendor.
Yeah.
Bessine, yeah.
I think you had it. But the sense that we're seeing this depiction through a viewpoint that is predisposed to be already racist...
Yes.
...makes it somehow... I mean, it's still racist, but it's fascinating to see the portrayal through that remove where... The film is acknowledging this caricature while still showing you, well, this is how I remember it. This is how it would have happened.
Yes.
And that says more about, I think, the people of Rimini than it does about the Emir.
And that is, that it seems like it's the other scene. It's the counterpart to Gradiska.
In the parlor.
Trying to seduce the fascists. Yeah. So that's neat.
This pursuit of power that... ultimately no one is satisfied by, but we leave before it gets bad, which makes it possible to see the film as pleasantly nostalgic rather than, well, and 10 years later everybody is in ruins and misery.
Well, the person who seems to see it for what it is Aurelio, the father, and he has been associated with this phonograph that was put up in the bell tower where they played the Communist Internationale, and then they thought someone was up there with a violin probably playing, and they realize, and then they're shooting, and you don't know if it's a person, then you see the phonograph and it comes down, and so he's somehow implicated. And then that horrible scene, even though as far as torture goes, it's not compared to other torture, I mean the real torture, but the fact that he's taken to the police station and forced to drink the castor oil,
which is a little boy's punishment. Right?
Yeah.
That's the other thing that struck me, is that it's really, it feels like it's not bad because it's something that was a cliche at the time.
Yes.
But it's horrible.
I mean,
it's portrayed as horrible.
Yeah, castor oil and urine has a lot of roles. Between the uncle who has to go and relieve himself and doesn't undo his pants.
And the scene in the classroom where...
That incredible scene in the classroom, and I was going to say when Tita is caught, because in the movie theater he urinated over the balcony onto the hat of one of the the superintendent or something of the school or something like that. But that incredible scene that you mentioned with the urinal where they take the paper and roll it up, and this one guy in the class is urinating, and it goes several rows down to the front, and then they get rid of the paper, so it looks like the boy who's addressing the math teacher, who is sexy to these boys, and that he's urinated. Obviously, it's so complex, but it's so magical and it's so funny. Did you hear what Fellini did when he was in class? He did something much more complex than that.
I'm afraid to ask. How
do you get more complex than an elaborate? He and his friends created this little pulley system with a hook, and they had one teacher that they didn't like who wore a toupee. And they lowered the hook down to his toupee and then pulled it up, and his hair came off.
While he was...
Yeah, that's far more complex than the urine through the paper
trick. No, that takes, proper physics and engineering.
Yeah.
That is the sort of person who could make this movie.
Yes.
This sort of Rube Goldberg contraption of stories and pieces that fit together perfectly, even when they don't appear to fit together at all.
Yeah, that's true. And you don't care. You're delighted. You want to see what's next. And you're always surprised. And then, like the magic in the film, the dream, the incredible dream imagery of the little boy, the younger brother of Tita, going to school, and it's that foggy morning, and there are those trees that look like horrible creatures, and then one looks like a destroyed ship. And then... he's in through the fog, he sees that longhorn steer or bull, and it's a terrifying but magical image. And then the grandfather's out too, and he can't find his home, and you feel so bad for him, and then it turns out he's a couple meters from his front gate. These are really powerful and very primal moments and dreams. It's the kind of thing your psychoanalyst would have you dig into and try what does that mean to you? And they mean a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if that was it for Fellini, why he never did another one like this. It's just he got it all out, that this was his reckoning with his childhood or his nation.
Yeah.
Satyricon sort of does it as well politically, but he was never... Yeah, it's just such a strange outlier in his own filmography, and it's so essential. It explains everything about him, and it puts the other films in context in a weird way, both before and after. But it's just so specific and weird that, it continues to fascinate me.
Yeah, that psychoanalytic dream thing, I don't really know what his experience was. I know Bertolucci had years of psychoanalysis and mined it, harvested it for imagery within his films. And allowed his own sexual preferences, as Fellini does. I mean, maybe that's an Italian thing. Tarantino, I guess, is Italian, his background.
I don't know that feet play that much of a role in any other filmography.
I think Buñuel, maybe.
Oh, I suppose.
But not to the extent of Tarantino.
Yeah, he's perfected it.
But I really do think... Fellini doesn't hold back in terms of what his things are. Yes. That thing.
I guess you've sort of touched on it already, but the influence on your own career and what you've taken away from it seems fairly profound.
I think what it did was taught me not to have fear about mixing forms, about having fun within a form. Even my very first professional film when I was at Rhombus in 1984, was called Making Overtures, the story of a community orchestra. And even there, I wasn't scared of doing a few little, within its verite format, to have occasionally a little surrealism. The conductor's showing a soloist around the town of Coburg where this is happening, and he refers to the owner of the dress shop is a double bass player, and he points out to the store, and there she is carrying her double bass down and waving to them, and it's like, what? How did that happen? And there's a number of those things in that, or a couple of things like that I have fun with, and I continue to have fun. One of the last films that I most recent films I did was called Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas, and it had to do with it's about Jewish composers of Christmas songs.
Sure. Yeah.
And it has which are many Christmas songs were written by Jewish composers, but it deals with serious subjects, even though people think of it as a joyous, fun film to watch. It deals with anti-Semitism, and it deals with a lot of heavy stuff. But it's that contrast. It's that blend, and being able to, like, okay, this is a documentary, but it's also a drama, and it's also a performance film, and it's also verite, and it's also, it's like, not that Fellini did that so much, but he kind of did.
Well, he allowed for it, right? Like, he would open those doors and blur the barriers.
Yes.
And let the music or the image or the personality follow it. He would follow it, rather, in whatever direction it was taking him. And White Christmas is such a sad song. No one gets that because it's not a White Christmas. It's someone dreaming of one. It's about... Sorry, I always come back to that point because it's like, this is not a... It's not a happy song. It's a wish for happiness.
Yeah. It's like Charlie Chaplin's Smile is one of the saddest songs there is, even though it's called Smile. Whereas Lou Reed has a song about called Smiles, and it's about, don't let anyone see you smile because they're going to want to rip you down. Don't let people see that you're actually happy. It's actually a happy song, even though it's presented in a negative way. Smile is a very sad song, even though people think it's happy because it's called Smile.
Yeah. People like the packaging.
Yeah.
That's the thing we keep coming back to.
Yeah. Well, White Christmas is an interesting song to me. That's not where I was going, but because I think, you know how everybody wants it to be a White Christmas? Mm-hmm. I think that's because they know the song. I don't think that was a thing. I don't think a snowy Christmas is what people wanted before. It's because this Jewish Russian guy wrote a song called White Christmas that now everyone wants a White Christmas. Right. It shows how art affects life. Yeah. And in a way, when we see a great movie, that's also, you know, it can totally change your prism on things. I mean, I always joke, my wife will kill me because she'll listen to this, but she wouldn't even want to go on a toilet after Jaws because she was so scared of water. but it's true. I mean, everything is, when you see something that's so powerful, When I saw Raging Bull and they used the music of Cavalleria Rusticana, I mean, when Scorsese did that, that's the music of my main central scene in my orchestra film, and I use a lot of slow motion in it, and that music, it's very poetic, and I think that's what led to that film being nominated for an Oscar, because people were so taken by that scene, which I just ripped off from Raging Bull. But,
it's powerful. I mean, it makes sense. And like the flash, like the swinging light bulb, you just carry forward the things that touch you, the things that impress you.
Yeah.
The things that resonate.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Like they're stored back there and it's like, oh, I've always wanted to do that. I had a scene in my film on Arnold Schoenberg, of all things, that had a sled that looked just like the Rosebud sled. It's like... First of all, who's going to notice it?
Yeah, if you're going to have a sled in a movie, why not? I can totally understand. Is there a scene or an image from Amicor that you consciously referenced? Something that you've actually used yourself? Orchestral notes? Calliope? Something here or there?
There's something very beautiful about Amicor that... is its use of dream imagery, which is I've been influenced by that at times, but also a real sense of movement and yes, Calliope, and that up and down movement, the swaying quality. It's almost like you are a baby in your mother's arms. And I started to do certain things where I would, in some of my films, I would have this dolly that would just go back and forth and back and forth. And I'm not the only one who does that, but it's this idea of not being aware of movement so much, but just that feeling of breathing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that I kind of was influenced by. You know, it sounds pretentious to talk about, oh, I'm influenced by Fellini, you know, but
it's inevitable, really.
Yeah.
Give yourself a wide enough
range of exposures. I was thinking, when I was talking about humor and seriousness, you know, I just did a film on propaganda, and I call it propaganda, the art of selling lies. I'm very, you know, not all propaganda is lies, but I was very angry because I would look at Trump tweets and, and these are the things that got me angry.
Well, we're recording this, what, 2 days after he claimed that Obama was trying to get a meeting with Kim Jong-un for 8 whole years, which is a blatant lie, absolute bullshit. I mean, people from the State Department, Susan Rice came out and said, nope, not true, immediately, and we're still, like, he's still saying stuff.
Or really Trump Jr., Donald Trump Jr., saying Kamala Harris is not black. Yeah. You know, he's retweeting and starting that lie, that birther lie, in effect, again. Well, and so it's infuriating. But that film is a very intense film, but it's not all angry, and it's not all... Yes, it's about the history of propaganda, but it's also about artists. Artists who are incredibly inspired and who have done their own propaganda, but who also react against things. And there's a lot of humor. There's a lot of... Like, it's really wonderful to make a film about something so serious and angry and potentially earnest. I always say there's an important to not always being earnest. Right. And there's much laughter and lightness within the seriousness. And it's that contrast that makes the humor that much more humorous and the power and the darkness that much darker. And, you know, you look at something like Serpico, which was from the same year that I saw, and I love that film. That's a film that hasn't aged well for me. But it was such an important issue. Mm-hmm. And even Mean Streets. I shouldn't diss Mean Streets. I walked out of Mean Streets.
Really? Why?
Because I was too young to appreciate its artfulness.
Okay.
And I'm ashamed by that. And in fact, I don't... Every time I sit down and watch Mean Streets again, I don't, because I'm so embarrassed that I walked out of it. Whereas Taxi Driver, I was ready. And Raging Bull, I was definitely ready.
But that happens to people all the time. When we see stuff before we're prepared, like emotionally, or before we're mature enough to really understand it.
Yeah.
Give yourself another chance. It holds up. It's
good. I do find that in thinking about films, sometimes we want a certain film, and it's not the film we want. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happens to Fellini, or people who evolve into different forms, and we impose things on stuff. You can look at someone like Kubrick and say, okay, he's a master of so many genres, but he's essentially saying the same things. There's a certain disconnectedness about humanity and in his films. And it is the same film, whether you're looking at Barry Lyndon or The Shining or 2001 or Full Metal Jacket. And when you go earlier, it's a little different. But it feels like someone's work. It's an oeuvre.
Yeah.
And of course there are things that are Fellini-esque. But if you are in love with Amarcord, you may not like the earlier stuff. And a lot of the critics who loved the early stuff were actually fed up with Amarcord and devalued it.
Yeah, they wanted it to be about something, I think, was one of the things that I came across. That it is, but it's not didactically so. So you just, if you don't see it, you don't see it.
Yeah, so I've had that. I've had films that I did where there wasn't a lot of, even though it was about a composer's life, I didn't give a lot of facts of the composer because I wanted a snapshot, for instance, of the 90-year-old Joaquin Rodrigo, who wrote the famous Concierto de Aranjuez, and I have all these emotional stories, but not factual stories. So certain German critics, it was a German co-production, were very angry at me for not giving them facts. And because they imagined a certain film, they imposed a film that they wanted on it. But if you just relax and watch the film, it's an emotional film. So I start thinking, great, wonderful. I love it, actually. The thing about filmmakers and critics depends on our personality. I tend to think when somebody reviews my films negatively, they actually know more than... It gives them a sense of, this person really knows. They've exposed me.
Oh, I see.
They know I'm a fraud in doing what I'm doing. Whereas if people just like it, it's like, ugh, what idiots. They just, they've gone with the journey. They like my film. Why am I going here? Is it because you're with Now Magazine and I'm expecting you to write a negative review?
I think somebody else already reviewed Propaganda.
Yeah, right.
I believe it was positive.
That's okay. I've made a lot of films. And I've had a lot of negative reviews, and I've had a few positive reviews too. So it's okay.
Yeah.
My thanks to Larry Weinstein, whose new documentary, Propaganda, The Art of Selling Lies, opens in Toronto at the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Cinema this Friday, July 19th. Larry will be in attendance for a Q&A after the 6:30 p.m. show on Saturday the 20th, so you should probably aim for that one. Thanks also to Angie Power. She knows what she did. Larry's not on Twitter, and neither is his movie, but you can find Amarcord on Blu-ray and DVD in an excellent special edition from the Criterion Collection, and also streaming on the Criterion channel. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you enjoy the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network, including last Friday's episode of The Big Story, where I appeared to talk about the release pattern of Unplanned and the failure of the new Lion King. They fit together in context. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
All of us, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.